This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks. Now, I've not really done many postmodern works of literature on this list, Julio Cortázar's Hopscotch being the only one. It was something of a conscious decision, for the most part because a lot of postmodernist stuff isn't quite as accessible. It's the kind of work that only really appeals to literary critics, other writers, and Europeans. In fact, it's quite difficult to talk about postmodern literature and reference things like plot, character, and perspective. And that isn't usually what the narrative is about. Instead, the author uses his characters as something of a mouthpiece for what has become the classic problems of postmodernist criticisms. What is the relationship of a text to reality? Can an author impart meaning to the world through writing about it? Is writing a sacred responsibility or just a whimsical game? Do we write to engage with the world or to escape from it? Now, if that sounds like a load of academic mumbo-jumbo, it's because it is. Or at least, it can be. In the wrong hands, it can be downright awful. Yes, I'm looking at you, Ayn Rand. But in the right hands, in the hands of a great storyteller, it can be something of a revelation. Paul Auster's New York trilogy is no dry academic affair. The trilogy is ostensibly made up of three short novels and examines the changing reality of the main characters in a novel while also investigating the imbalance between the physical author of a book, the individual who puts his name onto the cover, and the authentic author, who may or may not be the same person. The trilogy follows, to some degree, the formulas of detective fiction. It is a genre device that both makes the work accessible to the everyday reader, as well as adding some postmodern flavor. It also imparts an evocative film noir quality to Auster's tales. Imagine Raymond Chandler and how he might have told stories if he had spent too much time reading contemporary literary criticism, or something like that.
It was a wrong number that started it. The telephone ringing three times in the dead of night, and the voice on the other end asking for someone he was not. Much later, when he was able to think about the things that happened to him, he would conclude that nothing was real except chance. But that was much later. In the beginning, there was simply the event and its consequences. Whether it might have turned out differently or whether it was all predetermined with the first word that came from the stranger's mouth is not the question. The question is the story itself, and whether or not it means something is not for the story to tell. As for Quinn, there is little that need detain us. Who he was, where he came from, and what he did are of no great importance. We know, for example, that he was 35 years old. We know that he had once been married, had once been a father, and that both his wife and son were now dead. We also know that he wrote books. To be precise, we know that he wrote mystery novels. These works were written under the name of William Wilson, and he produced them at the rate of about one a year, which brought in enough money for him to live modestly in a small New York apartment.
The first part of the trilogy, City of Glass, uses the conventions of the crime thriller in a metaphysical tale about a man in relation to solitude. Ghosts, the middle section, uses the detective story in showing a man forced effectively to tale himself. And the concluding part, The Locked Room, is an autobiography by the unnamed friend of a disappeared literary giant. Though the stories and styles are very contrasting, they are in essence all the same tale, with The Locked Room finally resolving the odyssey. You don't meet many real detectives in this book. Instead, you find writers who get caught up in strange mysteries. The characters in the New York trilogy always seem to be writing. They are writing stories or letters or poems or reports of their investigations, but despite their best attempts to circumscribe and explain the world with these texts, they only seem to cut themselves off more and more from life by devoting themselves to the written word. To add to the complexity, another writer, Paul Auster himself, plays a bit part from time to time in these stories. Or perhaps this is another Paul Auster, unrelated to the author of the book. In the world of the New York trilogy, where coincidence and chance constantly drive the action, almost anything is possible.
Well, this is a question that interests me. Because those phone calls came to me, I felt implicated in the story somehow. But at the same time, I've always been interested in the fact that when you're reading a novel, who's speaking? You see War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And then you open up the book and a voice is talking to you. Who is it? Is it Leo Tolstoy? Or is it some authorial voice that comes out of Leo Tolstoy? Is it Leo Tolstoy, the man who eats dinner and writes letters to his friends? Or is it the Leo Tolstoy who thinks deep thoughts about the world? Well, it fascinated me to take the name that's on the cover of a book, the supposed author, and put it inside the book and to see what happens. Ironically enough, the Paul Auster character, although he resembles me, has opinions that are diametrically opposed to mine about everything. And I'm trying to make fun of myself.
The New York trilogy is very much the quintessential postmodern work of fiction. It is ambiguous and open-ended, yet the stories also seem closed and almost claustrophobic, with the plots of the novels turning in on themselves. The book is multi-layered and invites the reader to approach it from many different angles, but also works as straightforward storytelling.
Because he spent no more than 5 or 6 months on a novel, for the rest of the year he was free to do as he wished. He read many books, he looked at paintings, he went to the movies. In the summer, he watched baseball on television. In the winter, he went to the opera. More than anything else, however, what he liked to do was walk. Nearly every day, rain or shine, hot or cold, he would leave his apartment to walk through the city, never really going anywhere, but simply going wherever his legs happened to take him. New York was an inexhaustible space. A labyrinth of endless steps, and no matter how far he walked, no matter how well he came to know its neighborhoods and streets, it always left him with the feeling of being lost. Lost, not only in the city, but within himself as well. Each time he took a walk, he felt as though he were leaving himself behind, and by giving himself up to the movement of the streets, by reducing himself to a seeing eye, he was able to escape the obligation to think. And this, more than anything else, brought him a measure of peace, a salutary emptiness within. The world was outside of him, around him, before him, and the speed with which it kept changing made it impossible for him to dwell on any one thing for very long. Motion was of the essence, the act of putting one foot in front of the other and allowing himself to follow the drift of his own body. By wandering aimlessly, all places became equal, and it no longer mattered where he was.
Yet Auster's greatest achievement may be his ability to achieve all this, while staying true to the pacing and narrative build of a detective tale. After all, there are plenty of deep postmodern books, but what makes this one stand out is that it is a real bona fide page-turner. You're listening to 50 Books in 50 Weeks, Bookmark, The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Well, I think it all began with a series of wrong numbers that I myself received, just as Quinn receives in the beginning of City of Glass. I was working on my earlier prose book, The Invention of Solitude, living in Brooklyn. It was, I think, roughly around 1980, early 1980. Telephone rang, and I pick up, and the voice on the other end said, is this the Pinkerton Agency? It was a very famous American detective agency. I said, no, wrong number, and I hung up. Next day, around the same time, the phone rang, and again, the same person with the same question. And again, I said, no, you have the wrong number, and I hung up. But the moment I hung up that second time, I said to myself, you fool. Why didn't you say you were the Pinkerton Agency and find out what all this case might be about?
You're listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Umar Paganampike Bagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks. Complicated cases, grisly gunplay, slippery suspects, determined detectives, and bitter betrayals. These are common expectations when we read crime fiction. From Arthur Conan Doyle's legendary Sherlock Holmes to the gritty, hard-boiled school of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, these stories always begin with a shocking crime. The tough, wise-cracking private detective quickly arrives on the scene, promising to do what the incompetent official authorities will not: crack the case. Righting wrongs and catching villains, the sleuth discovers clues and questions suspects. The criminal is always the same person that the reader least suspects, and the solution to the mystery leaves us with a brimming sense of satisfaction. But what happens when the detective can't solve the case? When even the most promising clues lead only to more? When paranoia invades the mind and turns the ill-equipped investigator into a psychotic?
On his best walks, he was able to feel that he was nowhere. And this, finally, was all he ever asked of things. To be nowhere. New York was the nowhere he had built around himself. And he realized that he had no intention of ever leaving it again. In the past, Quinn had been more ambitious. As a young man, he had published several books of poetry, had written plays, critical essays, and had worked on a number of long translations. But quite abruptly, he had given up all that. A part of him had died, he told his friends, and he did not want it coming back to haunt him.
The New York Trilogy by Paul Auster is, as one early editor said, Kafka goes gumshoe. Made up of three intensely short, cerebral novels published in 1985 and 1986, it would establish Auster as a talent to watch, a writer who could tickle the brains of highbrow literary critics and spin a good yarn, too. The novel's protagonist is a solitary writer named Quinn, who on three different nights gets a phone call from a man looking for Paul Auster of the Auster Detective Agency. The first two times this happens, Quinn simply tells the man that he has dialed the wrong number. But on the third night, Quinn succumbs to impulse and pretends that he is Paul Auster, private investigator. What follows is a surreal detective novel, at once playful and morbid, in which the clues trace the origins of language and the culprit is the madness on the far side of being alone.
Quinn, as you will recall, does hang up the first two times, but the third time he says yes. Instead of the Pinkerton Agency, it's Paul Auster, the detective. And I wanted to remain faithful to this rather bizarre set of circumstances.
The New York Trilogy helped usher in a new era of crime fiction. Featuring a metropolis plagued by dimly lit alleyways and a sense of violent emptiness, the novel playfully manipulates the classical tropes of crime and detection. Auster's mysteries dabble in existentialism and the ambivalence between good and evil, right and wrong. In these stories, the detective becomes hopelessly lost in a labyrinth of clues where the more he investigates, the more likely he is to lose his mind.
Just before I started this book, I met my wife, Siri Hustvedt, who I think resurrected me from the dead. And I think that if I hadn't met her, I might have wound up something like Quinn. Maybe not exactly like him, but emotionally like him. So I wanted to put her in the book. And in some sense, the book is an homage to her. And since she was married to me, I'm in the book too. But she told me when she read the passage, the narrator describes Quinn feeling the incredible thinness of her hand and the tiny bones in her hand. And she said, it was an uncanny experience shaking her own hand as she's reading a novel.
Yeah. Auster explains the essence of a good crime and detective mystery in the first novella, City of Glass. For those not already in the loop, he writes, there is nothing wasted, no sentence, no word that is not significant. Even the slightest, most trivial thing can bear a connection to the outcome of the story. Nothing must be overlooked. Auster conveys this philosophy through his protagonist, Daniel Quinn, a poet who settles for writing mystery novels for a living. There's a strong sense of comfort for old-school crime fiction junkies in the opening description of Quinn. Like the traditional gumshoe, Quinn is haunted by a tragic past. Writing mystery novels becomes his salvation, a way to live vicariously through his private eye narrator, Max Work. While Auster doesn't show Quinn visiting crime scenes or rectifying social injustice, we quickly learn that whatever he knows about crime has come directly from books, films, and newspapers. Mac's work is a detective we are all familiar with. He solves elaborate crimes, suffers beatings, and makes narrow escapes. To Quinn, work functions as his interior brother, his comrade, in solitude.
It was then that he had taken on the name of William Wilson. Quinn was no longer that part of him that could write books. And although in many ways Quinn continued to exist, he no longer existed for anyone but himself. He had continued to write because it was the only thing he felt he could do. Mystery novels seemed a reasonable solution. He had little trouble inventing the intricate stories they required, and he wrote well, often in spite of himself, as if without having to make an effort. Because he did not consider himself to be the author of what he wrote, he did not feel responsible for it, and therefore was not compelled to defend it in his heart. William Wilson, after all, was an invention, and even though he had been born within Quinn himself, he now led an independent life. Quinn treated him with deference, at times even admiration, but he never went so far as to believe that he and William Wilson were the same man. It was for this reason that he did not emerge from behind the mask of his pseudonym. He had an agent, but they had never met. Their contacts were confined to the mail, for which purpose Quinn had rented a numbered box at the post office. The same was true of the publisher, who paid all fees, monies, and royalties to Quinn through the agent. No book by William Wilson ever included an author's photograph or biographical note. William Wilson was not listed in any writer's directory. He did not give interviews, and all the letters he received were answered by his agent's secretary. As far as Quinn could tell, no one knew his secret.
However, like everything in the New York trilogy, appearances are deceiving. While the mean streets are punctuated by the sounds of sirens and obscenities, Auster's New York City is a world that appears familiar, yet at the same time strangely foreign. Auster achieves this by revealing his detective's preoccupation with the cityscape, where they become convinced the urban sprawl is really an elaborate pattern integral to solving their respective mysteries, that when solved will expose a much more sinister reality.
The traditional detective or mystery story answers questions. And I feel what I do is I ask them, and I don't really give any answers. So at times, these stories might resemble detective stories, but in the end, they're not. I'm using the genre in the way, say, that Cervantes used chivalric romance for other purposes, or the way, say, Beckett used vaudeville to do Waiting for Godot. It's a means to another end altogether.
New York City works as a device in the novel, a labyrinth made up of figments and hallucinations. Like characters, we are suckered in by the intrigue and deceptive promise that everything can somehow be connected. In a post-9/11 age of fear and estrangement, all the stories in the New York trilogy, while venturing into ambiguity and the absurd, have endings that, in an abstract sense, feel very real. And in the modern world, it is the prospect of an uncomplicated, heroic resolution to any sort of disconcerting crime or mystery that feels most artificial. After all, it is the mystique of the unsolved or insoluble that most excites our wild and occasionally paranoid imaginations. As Borges once shrewdly noted, the solution of a mystery is always less impressive than the mystery itself. Sometimes the complicated case is better left uncracked.
It was night. Quinn lay in bed smoking a cigarette, listening to the rain beat against the window. He wondered when it would stop and whether he would feel like taking a long walk or a short walk in the morning. An open copy of Marco Polo's Travels lay face down on the pillow beside him. Since finishing the latest William Wilson novel 2 weeks earlier, he had been languishing. His private eye narrator, Max Work, had solved an elaborate series of crimes, had suffered through a number of beatings and narrow escapes, and Quinn was feeling somewhat exhausted by his efforts. Over the years, Work had become very close to Quinn. Whereas William Wilson remained an abstract figure for him, work had increasingly come to life. In the triad of selves that Quinn had become, Wilson served as a kind of ventriloquist. Quinn himself was the dummy, and work was the animated voice that gave purpose to the enterprise. If Wilson was an illusion, he nevertheless justified the lives of the other two. If Wilson did not exist, he nevertheless was the bridge that allowed Quinn to pass from himself into work. And little by little, work had become a presence in Quinn's life, his interior brother, his comrade in solitude.
But where does this journey take the reader? Because Paul Auster is a master storyteller, one may often be puzzled but never bored. At the very best moments, one makes contact. In fleeting views, in an imaginary mirror, for an instant, we recognize the scene. It belongs to our own experience, real or dreamed, it doesn't matter. And one finds an answer to inner questions. And this is the basic contract. Tell me about me. Writers write, readers read to find out, to discover the questions they need.
Fate seems to suggest that no matter what we do, we're going to end up in the same place. Whereas chance says every minute is up in the air. We don't know what's going to happen next.
Next week, Ulysses by James Joyce. Yes, really. You've been listening to 50 Books in 50 Weeks. This is Bookmark on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.